For author R.O. Kwan, there's a reward for being so easily absorbed in her work.
I forget to eat. I forget I might be thirsty. All of that goes away and I'm gone. And that is the deepest, purest joy I know.
This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Appadoni. Today, you'll hear my conversation with author R.O. Kwan in front of an audience of book lovers. Think of all the books that have influenced who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. The Incendiaries revolves around a college romance, a cult, and an explosion at an abortion clinic. I asked R.O. Kwan what inspired her to write about such volatile topics.
I grew up so religious that until I was 17, I thought I was going to be a pastor. And then I lost that faith. And so I think the book was rooted in that split, that giant split between who I used to be and who I then became and who I am now. In a lot of ways, it was and still is the pivotal loss of my life around which my life has been organized. I feel very much as though I'm living in the aftermath of this large cataclysmic event. And yeah, so that was the sort of first reason I wanted to write this book. I wanted to write both about how wonderful it was to believe. In a lot of ways, I really loved being Christian. I hadn't wanted to leave. But also, I just wanted to write about how terrible it was to lose that faith too, which I think isn't necessarily intuitive to a lot of people who haven't experienced this kind of loss. Over time, I realized that a lot of people only ever really experience one part of the faith spectrum for themselves. You know, so a lot of people know a lot about what it's like to believe in an overarching, all-powerful deity who's intimately involved in every detail of your life. A lot of people don't have any experience of that, and maybe you believe instead that you're a collection of dust and cells and electricity, and when you die, and you turn into soil for the flowers. These are incredibly different worldviews, and it can be hard to speak across that divide. And because I had experienced these two extremes in a way, I wanted to write a book that could serve as a kind of imaginative bridge across different parts of the faith spectrum and perhaps shed light on what it's like to believe something drastically different than what you might believe.
It's an amazing character study. And people in this book the characters have lost faith, but in different ways. Mm. They've lost faith in different ways. They find faith in different ways. Are you very close to Phoebe? Is that a character that really reflects your background?
Not necessarily. I mean, I'd say they all feel very much like me, and they all feel in various ways not like me.
So you have those different parts within you of losing and finding again and searching.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the cult leader, which I think it was my interview with NPR was when I first said this, and then I asked that they and then I was sort of hoping that they wouldn't air it, but of course they did. So I'm just going to say it again. In a lot of ways, a cult leader, John Leal, was the easiest for me to write, like the most fun. And I think that that's partly because he taps into a part of me that is entirely dormant, the part of me who thought I could be, who was excited about being a preacher, who was excited about using words, which is what pastors do, right? You use words toward an effect, to try to convince people of something, to try to persuade people. And that's very much, in a lot of ways, that's not really what fiction is doing, but that is what a pastor is doing. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with my cult leader.
If you haven't read the book yet, I know a lot of people here have and a lot have not yet. The cult that you mentioned, mm-hmm. is gradually introduced. And when we first start reading about John Leal, we're not even sure that it's a cult. He just seems like this interesting kind of older guy who hangs around a college campus. He's not really creepy. Well, he's a little creepy. But he's not really creepy, though. Mm-hmm. He's just what you would find when you're a student, you're on campus, and you get to know some people who are sort of on the periphery of the college or university, who are a little bit older and a little interesting, and you're sort of drawn to him. So at first, it seems very natural. How did you decide how to introduce a cult? In a way, you introduced a cult to us as readers in the same way a participant might be.
That's such an interesting question. So what I usually tell people the book is about, if they ask, is I say it's about a woman who gets involved with a group of extremist Christians. The group turns out to be a cult, and they end up bombing abortion clinics, healthcare clinics, in the name of faith. It's always kind of wild for me to say this when I can see everyone's faces, because it's just like people, like, their eyes get sort of big, and then their eyebrows start growing higher and higher. there's like a room wide progression. So there's a cult, and the cult plays a large part in the book. I think in a lot of ways, I myself was never in a cult, but I was involved in a youth group when I was Christian that was absorbing enough that a lot of our parents were concerned it was a cult, and it wasn't, but I was drawing on some of those memories, on the memories of, I think especially when people are young, or, you know, I don't like generalizing. I think that's part of what I love about fiction, is its attachment to the particular. I know when I was a teenager, and even now in a lot of ways, I loved the absorption itself, you know, just being totally wrapped up in something can be intoxicating, can be rewarding in ways that maybe the rest of life isn't necessarily. And I think that was part of what drew me to wanting to write about a cult, to wanting to write about what it's like when you believe something, perhaps to the exclusion of a lot of other beliefs you may have held about the world, and what that can be like. So for instance, this is a pretty well-known piece of, like, Christian lore. The Trappist order, which is an order of monks, it used to be the most demanding, the most rigorous, the most exacting of orders. And not long ago, they chilled out. They made a lot of the physical requirements a lot less onerous. They asked a lot less of their novitiates. And immediately, fascinatingly, enrollment dropped. People were so much less interested in a less extreme version of the order. And I think this is often common. People want to believe with all their hearts, and that's not always available.
So interesting. You keep reading my mind here, because the next thing in my notes is Phoebe wants discipline. But she does. There's desire, there's obligation, there's privilege in her background, but there's also wanting attention. Tell us as much about Phoebe as you can without saying anything that would ruin the story for anyone.
Yeah. So Phoebe, she spent most of her life until she goes to college and meets the people in this book, believing that she could be a piano prodigy. And she is a really, really good pianist, but I don't think I'm giving too much away if I say that her piano hopes don't necessarily work out entirely the way she hoped. And that kind of a loss, I think, is and can be, and it certainly is for Phoebe, cataclysmic in ways that sometimes aren't legible. I think people don't necessarily see people who maybe had music as their entire lives and then gave that up. Don't see that as a tremendous loss. You know, maybe I think a lot of people think, well, you know, now you don't have to practice piano 8 hours a day. You can have a life. You can you can have fun like the rest of us. And often that's not how it feels. And I think with Phoebe, as well as with the loss of faith in general, I was interested in these kinds of loss that aren't necessarily legible. Because that was part of what was devastating for me when I lost the faith, when I left Christianity, was having what felt like this cataclysmic loss that no one could even see. It didn't make sense to anyone. Certainly didn't make sense to my community at the time when I was in high school, which was range from moderately Christian to extremely Christian. That was sort of the water I was in. I grew up in LA, outside of LA. And then when I went to college on the East Coast, all my new friends, they also couldn't make sense of it. You know, they were just like, at some point I would tell people, I was so religious until not long ago that I thought I was going to be a pastor. And their reactions were just like, huh, that's really weird. And they're like, well, good for you. Now you can drink and have sex like the rest of us. And I was like, well, you know, that's true, I guess. And drinking seems nice, I'm realizing. But it didn't feel like a jailbreak. It didn't feel like a liberation. And I don't say this lightly. I'm very close to my family. But I remember thinking for a long time that I would so much rather have lost my parents and my brother than have lost God, because the Christian God and my understanding of him promises to restore all loss. I used to live in a world in which I didn't think anyone I loved would really die. I used to believe we would all go on and on. It wasn't visible to anyone. It didn't make sense to anyone. And I was interested in exploring varieties of what it can be like when how you feel is so at odds with how you seem and how you act and how you look.
Phoebe's kind of interesting too, because she has a lot of doubt about mm-hmm. herself. She balances that in such an interesting way in the way she manipulates other people.
Mm.
So that sort of that balance of taking advantage of other people, manipulating other people, mm-hmm. trying to have them do what she wants them to do as mm-hmm. a part of her self-doubt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of that in people you knew? Were you aware of that in yourself?
That's such an interesting question. No one's asked that before. Phoebe is very charming. And she knows she's very charming. And I think she, in a lot of ways, distrusts her own charm, because she can see the effect she has on people. There is a line when she says something like, she couldn't walk through campus without people calling out her name. And she could see the liking on people's faces. But to her, she wondered if what people were seeing when they looked at her was their own reflection. Because she's so unhappy and she hates talking about herself. So she's always asking people about themselves. The way she moves through the world is through questions and rarely talking about herself, which means people love her, people find her to be very interested in them. It also means that she doesn't feel seen. She doesn't have a lot of people who know what's going on with her. And so I think she's that sort of mishmash of how she's read versus how she feels is a big part of who Phoebe is.
The word disciple.
Mm-hmm. Cheja. Yeah.
Okay. How does this fit in to this whole story? We have disciples who used to be disciples who want to be disciples. We have disciples who, people who want disciples following them around.
Yeah.
How did you decide to work Cheja into the story?
Let's see. So Cheja is the name of the cult, and it's named by John Leal, the cult leader, and it's a Korean word. What John Leal offers, and what I think I feel safe generalizing about this part at least, what cult leaders in general offer, what demagogues offer, what the orange clown offers, is certainty. And certainty can be incredibly appealing, especially to people who are hurt, who are lost, who are looking for answers, who are perhaps looking for answers outside of the framework in which they have been receiving answers before. And so I think this is the magical allure of John Leal, of cult leaders, pretty much everywhere as far as from what I've read and what I've come across in terrorist leaders. This is something that was really interesting to me in my research into cults and into extremist groups in general, is that they love recruiting at the high school and college level. And college is particularly appealing, especially in the US, because of course in the US, a lot of people go away to college. And so you're somewhere where it's a very liminal space where perhaps you haven't entirely decided who you are yet. You're figuring that out. Perhaps who you are is changing. You're away from everyone who knows you a certain way. And so college can be a very rich ground for cult recruiters.
Will, who is another person in the story, a boyfriend, a lover of mm-hmm. Phoebe, has a relationship with God mm-hmm. that is stronger than Phoebe's. In fact, he or someone in his circle refers to him as God-haunted. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of a relationship. How would you characterize Will's belief?
Yeah. Okay, so Will is the one who, he loves Phoebe and is opposed to the cult and much of what it represents. And he's the one who to whom I gave... his relationship with God is in a lot of ways the most emotionally autobiographical for me. Not in terms of like how every single fact matches up, but in terms of how it felt to lose that and what led to losing the faith. All of that, it was incredibly important to me that I get that down as accurately as I could from what I remembered of leaving the faith. And Will, in a lot of ways, he, like me, didn't want to leave Christianity. In a lot of ways, he envies the people who stayed. He envies people who have that kind of certainty that he's lost. And he's in a lot of pain. And it's particularly painful for him that the woman he loves is finding a version of what he lost not so long ago.
John Leal, who is the person who is the older person in this trio and is the person who is a leader of a cult, for lack of a better term, or two better terms, leader and cult are both sort of variables in there. But he sort of, you know, the other two are finding God, losing God, thinking about their relationships with God. John Leal thinks he is God.
Mm.
And he's taken on a role for himself that is pretty far up there, right? How do you describe him?
Well, I think an important part of how John Leal is presented is that it plays around with point of view, so that in some ways the book is narrated by these three characters who we're talking about. But in a lot of ways, it's actually narrated, I imagined it as being narrated by Will. I know a lot of people don't care about this when they write their books, but for me, for this book, it was important to me that the book have a reason to exist, even inside the fictional world of the novel itself. And so I thought of the book as Will, thinking back on his relationships, especially his relationship with Phoebe, and trying to understand how the woman he loves fell into a cult, and how she probably was involved in blowing up these buildings. And that's what happens, right? Like after every atrocity, after every terrible shooting, people ask why, how did this person I knew and I love become this what seems like an entirely different person? And that sort of question asking is at the heart of the book. And so this is a long way of saying that the book is limited to what Will can know about what happened and or what he can imagine. And so John Leal is a relatively opaque figure in the book. We don't necessarily get behind his eyes as much. We don't necessarily know as much about what he's thinking. But that's in large part because Will doesn't necessarily understand John Leal very well at all. And of course, John Leal draws part of his power, as leaders like this often do, draws part of his power from a strategic opacity. He maintains that opacity. He changes his answers when people ask him questions. I've thought a great deal about the difference between the Joker and Magneto, as superhero villains go. So Magneto is an incredibly understandable villain, right? Like he has a whole origin story with, he had family during the Holocaust and he was in a camp and he is a mutant and he does not trust humans because he has seen with his own life what happens when a group of people are viewed as being different. And so that's why he wants to wipe out humanity, because he's on the side of the mutants. And that's Magneto. Joker, every time someone asks him why he has, why he's smiling, why he has that terrible slashed up smile, at first he tells a story about, I forget which one it was, he tells a story about, I don't know, he had a girlfriend who betrayed him, blah, blah, something happens. And you're just like, okay, fine, fine. So that's your villain origin story. Second time around, he tells a different story. Third time around, he starts telling a different story. And that's so much creepier than when you can understand what's going on behind that smile. And I think I was thinking about that kind of when you're not sure who someone is, how there can be so much power in that.
Well, that explains why I was reading the character of John Leal as being completely delusional. Whether or not he was isn't the point. I was seeing him through Will's eyes, mm-hmm. and Will saw him as rather delusional. But he's also pretty guilt-ridden.
He says he is. he says he is. I think there's a lot of ambiguity about the extent to which he can be trusted about some of the things he says. And Will certainly, regardless of how trustworthy he seems, Will certainly does not find him to be a very trustworthy human.
Will is pretty trustworthy.
This is so interesting.
Do you think Will is pretty trustworthy?
I mean, so I should say that, like, my mentor in graduate school, and he's still my mentor, Michael Cunningham, who's a wonderful writer, he said something that I think about all the time, which is, we must love our characters as God does and not more. Which to me means, or part of what it means, is that I'm never ever dictating to my characters who they are. I think of writing as a sort of prolonged listening in a lot of ways. I'm trying to find out who the characters are. I'm asking them to show me what they want, what they're doing next, why they're even in a book together. I've been working on my new book I should stop calling it a new book, because I've been working on it for 3.5 years already. It's just a book, right? It's not new anymore. Nothing 3.5 years old is really new. But I was working on it recently, and I was up late, and I had some wine. And then at some point I realized I looked up and I had typed in all caps. Who are you people? What do you want from me? How are you failing? Oh, how am I failing you? That's very much, I follow the characters rather than ever feel as though I'm making a decision about what they're doing next or who they are. And so I love all of these characters, I'm very interested in all of them. There have been so many different reads of Will. There have been a lot of people have found him to be an unreliable narrator in a lot of ways. Someone who, as much as he's trying to understand what happened, is perhaps also, to a certain extent, engaged in excusing what happened, and excusing the role he has played in the book's events,
we all do that.
Yeah, exactly. Which we all do, right? Like, if you start telling a story about the day, I'm so fascinated by the disconnects between the stories we tell ourselves about who we are, versus how other people might perceive us. And so, you know, like, if I go to Trader Joe's and someone is blocking the aisle with the giant goddamn cart, and I'm ruder than I am comfortable being, because in the moment I fly into a rage because I'm in a rush and I can't understand why someone would block the aisle. In my head, I am not the villain of that story. To the woman who was blocking the cart and was perhaps just not thinking about it, who has a woman storming down the aisle and going, and then, like, maybe moving the seat and moving the cart and looking incredibly angry, I was perhaps not the hero of that story. And perhaps to this woman, she's the hero, and she had some rude-ass woman push past her and wrecked her night. And so I think
she just moved the cart to get rid of you. She just I'm getting out of her way.
So I think I'm always so interested in that. And I think that's part of what I love about fiction, is the way we can inhabit other people's points of view in a way that I think is not available in this way anywhere else. You know, like, I mean, I love listening to music, I love watching movies, all of it, but books are what give me direct hits of someone else's consciousness. And this is what I this is part of what I just find to be endlessly fascinating about writing and reading.
the book starts with a paragraph about the explosion, and then at the end we find out why was there an explosion? What happened? How did these people get together? Who exactly was responsible for the explosion? But I wondered, as a writer, did you say, okay, we're going to have an explosion, and it's going to be these people. Wow, these people are really interesting. I'm going to write more about them. Wow, look where they... So what was the process? Did you decide to write about people and they needed an action, or did you decide on a topic that was going to happen and then get caught up in the characters?
I always start writing fiction with always. What am I talking about? I'm working on my second book. Like I haven't.
Always.
There has been one book, and now I'm working on my second one. So that isn't an always. But so far to date, I have started with a question. And the central question for me with the incendiaries was, what happens when people who love one another believe entirely different things about the world? What happens as a result of that? And then the questions breed more questions. And so writing to me feels like a constellation of questions that it's not even necessarily that the questions get answered, but the questions just lead to more questions for me. I didn't begin really with the characters or with an explosion. I began with this rift in worldviews. That said, pretty early on, so starting at about the 2-year mark, I worked on this novel for 10 years, by the way. It was a long period. So 2 years was really early on in that process. And around the 2-year mark, I realized that there were probably going to be buildings exploding. And I think once I realized that, it was clear to me that that was going to happen at the start. I tend to be so much less interested when I read and when I watch things in what happens than in how and why. And so much so that I often find on the first read of a book, I'm too stressed out about the fate of the characters to really slow down and appreciate the language and lose myself in the book the way I want to. And so it's only on the reread that I'm able to do that. Once I know that whatever, the character is going to marry the person that if they don't marry, they're going to have no money and be starving because this is a 19th century book set in the UK. You know, just this really became clear to me with Friday Night Lights. Did any of y'all watch that? Oh my God, I love that so much. I'm not even all that interested in like football or high school, but it's incredible. But I was so stressed out watching Friday Night Lights that very soon I realized I needed to read all the Wikipedia entries about what's happening in each episode before I could even watch the show, because I was always so worried. Like, is this person going to get a football scholarship? That decides their whole life. I need to know, and then I could relax and really sink into the narrative, even on the sentence level. So when I'm trying to understand what the next sentence will be, it helps me so much to not just like imagine that there are infinite possibilities, but instead to look back at what is there. And often with what I already have, there are signposts showing me where I could go next, because I wanted the book to feel as though it couldn't possibly have been any other way. Sontag talks about, she uses this phrase I love, lexical inevitability, to talk about the prose of poets, and how often when you really love a paragraph, when you really love a poem, it can really feel as though if you moved one comma, if you moved one word, it would be weakened. The poem would be worse. The paragraph wouldn't be as good. And I wanted the book to feel as though every word couldn't possibly have been any other way. It didn't feel done to me until it was at a point where I could open it at random, read 2-3 sentences, and not want to change a single thing about them. And so, yeah, that took 10 years.
How much of that happens in editing and rewriting, and how much of it happens the first time through? Are you that tied to the commas and the perfect words the first time through to find out where the story is taking you, or does that come in as corrections later?
I am very tied to it, so much so that I'm very tied to commas, to punctuation, to the word choice in the moment, so much so that in early drafts I've learned that I need to do everything I possibly can to put to the side my obsession with language, with commas, with and truly, I mean, commas are so great. I love punctuation so much. I can think about punctuation all day. There was one draft of the book when so in my editor for this book, her name is Laura. She's wonderful. I met someone who cares as much about punctuation as I do. And what this meant was there was an entire draft that we worked on where essentially we were much of the work was happening around the punctuation. And at some point she said, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about your semicolons. And I was like, I can't sleep because I'm thinking about my semicolons. And she very reasonably asked me in this draft to, anytime I did not take an accepted edit, she asked me to put in a comment sort of explaining why, what my thinking was. And so, you know, in Microsoft Word, how those comments sort of pop up as flags on the side. So by the end of this really not very long book, we had, there were over 1,000 comments inside the document. And that's when I did not want to take a suggested edit. So there were others that I did take. And so much so that the document was in a state where I was, every time I saved it, that terrifying wheel would come up and it would start sort of whirring around. I'm like, oh God, I'm gonna lose everything. My life is over. But yeah, no, it all turned out fine. But yeah, so I really do believe that if a semicolon is turned into a colon, but it should have been a semicolon, then the sentence is ruined. If the sentence is ruined, the paragraph is ruined. If the paragraph is ruined, the page is certainly ruined. Then the whole book is ruined, and you might as well just start all over again. And so, you know, that's nice. It's nice that I get so much joy from these details. But this is not great for me in early drafts. So in early drafts, I do all kinds of things to get over this obsession and to not be able to see the sentence as a unit the way I can in later drafts.
You did something else that I thought was very interesting. I think it's called conditional perfect, the tense that you use. Mm. It's the tense, I had to look it up because I didn't know. It's the tense that is, I'd have wanted. A lot of books are written in past tense, but this conditional perfect, I'd have wanted to do something. What made you decide to write so much of it in that tense?
Yeah, that's such a great question.
And is it just one? I couldn't tie it to just one character. First I thought, yeah, oh, maybe that's just how Will talks or Phoebe talks. I couldn't really tie it to any one person.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I love thinking about tenses, too.
Were you aware that you were changing tenses as you wrote?
Yeah, I'm very alive to tenses in general with prose because there are parts of it when the novel is not being narrated from Will's point of view, he's trying to imagine what Phoebe and John Leal, the cult leader, would have said for themselves, how they might have experienced the same events that he's thinking about. And so he uses this tense a lot, especially when he's narrating what he thinks the other two would have experienced because he doesn't know. And so he's guessing, he's imagining, he's re-piecing things together from what he remembers, from pieces of what seems to be a journal that Phoebe leaves behind. And all of that means that there's a lot of doubt in his narration. And I thought that this tense conveyed a lot of that doubt.
Yeah, it really does. That was a good choice, but it was a choice I don't think I have seen, not too many places, if at all.
Mm.
It was very interesting. There's also, this is far from a violent book, I don't want to misrepresent it, but there are a couple of places, two or maybe three places, where something violent is happening. How do you know as a writer when you've gone too far with violence?
I'm not sure that I would put it to myself that way with fiction, because I think I really am so interested in following the characters, you know? And so there are, there's a key moment of violence in the book that I won't name because I know people get very upset about spoilers, but anyone who's read the book will know what I'm talking about. And when I started realizing what might be happening, I myself was not only surprised, but really dismayed. I was just like, seriously? This is who you turned out to be. The part of me who's not a writer, and the part of me who does have thoughts about what other people are up to in the world. That part was outraged and really, really saddened. And I tried very hard not to write that scene the way it ended up playing out. I wrote so many versions of that scene in which the thing I'm talking about doesn't happen. And then they just kept ringing so false to me, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. So I went back and I read everything I had, and I realized there was something about this one character. There are ways in which he privileges his own desires. There are ways in which he looks at women. There are ways in which he is interested in his desires at the expense of other people's desires. That would make what he does in this given moment the most likely thing for him to do. And so it would have felt just terribly false to me in the end if that scene hadn't happened the way it had. And I think that kind of logic is what is how I work through fiction in general, is if there's something that where I'm wondering, where did this come from? Why is this happening? And if resisting it seems like a lie, then I need to go back and find out what it is about, the material at hand, what it is about the characters as I know them so far that might lead to a certain outcome.
There is something that happens in some religions, in some traditions, and in some cults where there's a pace that picks up and picks up and picks up until you reach that ecstatic place and are sort of swept away and carried away with the belief. Your book's pace does that. I thought it was my imagination, so I went back to the beginning and read some of the beginning of it again. I don't mean to say it's slow at the beginning, but it's evenly paced at the beginning, and then it picks up and picks up until we get to the point at the end where this explosion is happening. And I found, you know, a little bit of heart racing, and then I realized that is in keeping with some cult activity. Were you aware of that as you were writing? That would be a no.
No, it's not. I'm interested in pacing, and I think about it a lot. But to me, maybe I'll put it this way. It has been a delightful surprise for me to learn that a lot of readers have said that they found this to be a very plotful book. And a lot of people have read it in one night. So have said that they read it, they couldn't fall asleep until they finished it. And that has been a delightful surprise to me, is how I'm putting it, because I don't think about plot as plot. There's a wonderful line in a Laurie Moore short story where there's a character who's a writer, and she's like a terrible writer at the start. And then her high school teacher says to her, "You don't have the faintest idea of what a plot is." And then as she walks out away from her teacher, she mutters to herself, "Plots are for dead people." And I think about that a lot, because I think for me, thinking about plot and pacing separately from the characters feels so artificial to me. What I'm interested in is, what do they want? Desire makes sense to me. What do the characters want in every given moment? What do they want from one another? What do they want from themselves? Often when I feel as though I don't know what's going on in a scene, when I don't know what a character is going to do next, what helps the most is to ask myself, just to actually try to like physically project myself out of my body into the character's body, and to ask myself, what are their desires? Because I don't think anyone ever, I mean, maybe if you're like an extremely enlightened Buddhist monk, but otherwise, it's rare that one sits around having zero desires, right? Like, even if it's just for like a glass of water and for your friend to text you back so you know they're not mad at you. Like, these are desires. These are strong desires. So I follow desire. I don't like map out and think overtly about pacing and plot.
Have you always been fascinated with storytelling?
I'm not sure that I think of writing itself even as storytelling. So maybe that's.
Well, tell me the difference.
I think because storytelling to me leans more heavily on what happens and on and on this notion of plot. It feels to me like a more traditional form of writing, I'd say, a more traditional way to think about writing. And I think I'm less interested in that and more interested in, I don't know, people are so interesting, you know? People in general are so interesting. Isn't it amazing to, there's something C.S. Lewis says in A Grief Observed, which is a gorgeous, heartbreaking book. If you ever want to read a book that'll leave you just feeling really, really, really sad. he really loved his wife, and then he lost his wife. And for all his, he of course was very Christian, and for all his Christianity, it wasn't a consolation. He wanted his wife back. And this book is written sort of in the aftermath of his wife's death, and not long afterward. And it's sort of raw with grief in a way that it moved me so much. And he says in there, and I think about this all the time, he says in there, I'm sick of people telling me you have your memories. And he says, I don't want the memories. My wife surprised me every day of her life that I was with her. I want the surprises. I want my wife back. I don't want what I already know. And I think about that because I think everyone I love, the people I'm closest to, surprise me all the time. I'm always astonished by, like, I'll expect my husband to react in a certain way to, like, a joke. Perhaps if I think I'm telling him a funny joke, and then he'll think it's not funny, and then he won't laugh. And that's startling to me, and fascinating that people remain so unknowable, even when they're the people I know the best. And even when I'm thinking about myself, because I think I'm also fascinated by the ways in which I remain unknowable to myself. And I think that's part of what I love about fiction.
Were you aware in the part of your life where Christianity was very strong, mm-hmm. and you thought you were going to be a preacher or a pastor, were you aware of the role that stories and characters in those books, in those great books that you were studying at the time, were you aware of a connection with those stories?
Do you mean with the stories of the Bible, for mm-hmm. instance? Yeah, I mean, I think that is part of the early appeal for children, certainly of the Bible and of a lot of religion, is that there are such great stories in there. And yeah, I think that's something. Pastors tend to be good storytellers. The Bible is full of really fascinating stories. And I think that is part of its power.
It's sort of, I hadn't thought about it, but it makes a lot of sense that somebody who has taken the path that you've taken away from that career into being a novel writer, it's a different way to tell a story, even though that's not mm-hmm. the term that you mm-hmm. would use, but mm-hmm. it's a different way to use words, and it's a different way to use language. So it seems like a very natural path for you to take.
Yeah. I mean, there is something about, because what one can know directly of when I was a Christian, what I knew directly of God was through language, right? It was through the Bible. There was no other direct access to what God was said to have said and what God was said to want. So I think I've always been interested in, well, Marilyn Robinson says something really beautiful about what was lost when the language in the King James Version stopped being the de facto language that people learned when those who were Christians who read the Bible, when they read the Bible. And you just because that language is so beautiful and that language is so close to, for instance, the language in Shakespeare. And so the language in Shakespeare was much more familiar to a lot of people than it is now, because so many people grew up with the King James Bible. And I'm still tremendously moved by a lot of the language in the Bible, but as language, not as anything telling me how to run my life.
You mentioned the unknowable part of yourself. What did you learn about yourself? Of course, you've been talking about a lifetime. I don't want to go through all of it. But during the course of the time that you were writing The Incendiaries, what did you discover?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. You ask such interesting questions. let's see. You know, I really love writing. I really, really love it. I think that's even when it's really hard, and it's often so hard. It doesn't happen every day, but every now and then I get to a place where I'm deep in the writing, deep in a sentence, trying to make it the best version of itself it can be, really moving around that comma. And I get so absorbed that I really do forget all sense of myself. I forget I have an eye. I lose all sense of time. I forget to eat. I forget I might be thirsty. All of that goes away and I'm gone. And that is the deepest, purest joy I know. And it's something that I feel so lucky to have. I feel so lucky to love something this much. Because, I mean, it is possible to, and I've certainly thought this a lot, it's possible to think something like, how the hell did it take me 10 years to write one book? What is the matter with me? What is this life? That's one way to think about it. But I can also think about it as, I got to spend 10 years with one book. Like, what a privilege to be so perplexed and fascinated by something that it can take me, that I can spend 10 years with a book and remain fascinated. And that I can do it all over again for 3.5 years and counting.
The next one's not going to take 10, though, is it?
I'm hoping for like 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's been 3.5, and I know I'm not a fast writer. I'm hoping for 6. It's shorter than, by the 8-year mark with the first novel, I started getting really hung up on the fact that it's 2 U.S. presidencies. I was just like, Obama spun through like his entire, he's been president and he's gone. That's 8 years. He's done so much. What have I done?
This book took 10 years. The next one, 6. And the one after that and the one after that. So in 50 years, when people of any generation 50 years from now are looking back at your work, reading your books, what is your legacy? What do you want them to know about the writing and the work, the body of work in the future?
Again, such an interesting question. Honestly, I don't think I've been asked that. I think first of all, 50 years from now, I will be so delighted and so surprised, so pleasantly surprised, if 50 years from now, I have the prospect of like dying in my bed. You know, I just the way things look, I think that would be a surprise. Versus, you know, like the apocalypse coming and humanity dying out, a jellyfish taking over. So I don't really know what the jellyfish would think of literature, but they are supposed to be really smart. Have you ever read about the jellyfish situation? It's wild. There are so many jellyfish in the sea, and they love anaerobic conditions, so they're thriving in the terrible conditions that we've created in the ocean. And the jellyfish are like one of the only species that love us and like love what we've done to this earth. Anyway, I wanted to write a book. Let me put it this way. I wanted to write a book that with this book and with my writing in general, I wanted to write a book that not only a book that I could read, open in the middle, read 2 sentences of, and not want to change them all over again, but I wanted to write a book that 20 years from now, I would still feel that it was in a form that I didn't want to desperately change all over again. So yeah, so we'll see how that goes.
Aro Kwan, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you all so much. This is so lovely.
Authors for Cap Radio Reads are selected by Cap Radio's content and marketing teams. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Recording engineers are Mark Jones and Antonio Munoz. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books online, capradio.org/reads. Keep up with our latest conversations by subscribing to Cap Radio Reads on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. While you're at it, check out our other podcasts. Find them at capradio.org/podcasts. I'm Donna Appadoni. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Cap Radio.